Maybe we'll give Dr. Stewart a minute. All right, I think we can get started. Good morning, everybody. This is 8:30 a.m., and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Poe, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina? Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhouse?
Present.
Mr. Wynn? Mr. Wynn, you're muted.
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you now. Present. Thank you. We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. This meeting is being held virtually, as you all know, and the public has been properly notified of the options to attend and observe the meeting. Remarks and announcements. Please keep in mind that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one item, go to a new item, and then come back to the previous item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you for continuing to use the raise hand feature because I think it just reduces the stress for everybody, and then everybody gets a chance to speak. So regarding the board survey, the board encourages everyone in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I want to take this opportunity to thank everybody, board members, staff, our Assistant Attorney General, for the hard work that they put into getting prepared for this meeting. I know it's a lot of reading and a lot of things to digest, and sometimes we get things at the last minute that we also have to get prepared for. So I do appreciate everyone's efforts in getting prepared because I think that just increases the quality of our deliberations when everybody's prepared. So thank you. Regarding continuing education credit for the meeting attendance, the attendance at this meeting is eligible for 4 hours of for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. Should the duration be more than 4 hours, then watch out for the code words that will be provided during the meeting. And then you can report those code words to the board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit. The link is on the board's meetings page for this particular meeting. Within the next several weeks, board staff will verify the licensee's earned credits in their CE broker accounts when you report them. Please note that this meeting may not be for more than 4 hours, and it is possible that continuing education credits will not be awarded if that happens. So thank you for your understanding. Number four on the agenda is call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS Section 38-431.02, subsection H, the board may only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda if applicable. So if you wish to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I'll call on you.
Mr. Chair, this is Diana Davis Wilson, and I would like to speak.
Good morning, Dr. Davis Wilson. Thank you
Thank
for coming, and yes, please go ahead.
you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I just wanted to ask today, I wanted to speak just quickly regarding agenda item number 12, specifically relating to Rule 426-406. I know you guys will discuss it shortly. I just wanted to make a friendly request to possibly kick that back to the CBA with a few considerations. The first one's going to be that in listening to the commentary that was presented in the CBA meeting, I think there is a need for a discussion on how the ethics code is revised in that process as it pertains to the BACB's accreditation. Dr. Davey was not present for that conversation, the full conversation, and I think that he may be able to actually present to kind of why the ethics code has multiple renditions within it, specifically that they're all, anytime you see an update that isn't a copywritten update, those are just going to be updates that are clerical, or they're going to be aesthetic in nature. So they changed their logo. So the most recent update is just a change in the logo. But the actual content goes through an entire accreditation process that includes some stakeholder feedback and conversations. And so I just wanted to give them the opportunity with that information to kind of revisit that. I'm also a little bit concerned at the frequency in which the codes change. Right now, we're still a growing field. And so when we put a specific rendition in there, while I understand its intent and its importance, I also know that as we're getting new BCBAs coming in from out of state, we're struggling to see that they're understanding, hey, this is the license and it's different than what the certification does. So when we put a specific date in there that may be different than the current rendition, I do have concerns about that confusion. I also think that there is a strong likelihood that the House bill for the separation of the boards is going to go again next year, at which point there would be a good opportunity to represent the rule writing consideration. And I think one of the things that we probably need to consider is just the backlog of applications right now, and all of this additional work that board staff is working very, very diligently to get through. They have a lot on their plate, and I think going through rule writing process right now might be quite challenging on top of the other burdens that they are facing. To kind of combat it, I am an ethics professor. I've spent a lot of time looking at the current statutes for unprofessional conduct and the ethics code. And I do think that the statute itself captures the majority. The pieces that it doesn't are things like making sure that you copyright the behavior and the certification board's materials correctly. I'm not sure an issue of public protection. But aside from that, I do think that the statutes currently capture the large majority of the ethics code. And so I just think that perhaps the CBA can reconsider, look at some of the, expense, the time and efforts that would take, and maybe have a difference. I mean, I don't know if it'll change their mind, but I do think there's additional information that could support them. And that is all. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson, and thank you for your insights. We'll definitely discuss this because it's on our agenda, and you're welcome to stay and see our deliberations and offer additional insights as needed if you feel the need to do so. Anybody else who wishes to speak at this time, you may do so now. All right, hearing none. Let's go to number five, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates?
I do not have any update. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. So let's go to number six, consent agenda. Are there any recusals from items on the consent agenda? I think Dr. Stenhoff has registered recusal for 6A. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, sorry for the delay. I was looking for the button to raise my hand. Yes, that is correct. So,
Thank you. And Dr. Katerina.
I just had a very brief recusal for 6G, Dr. Reed.
All right. Dr. Davey.
Yes, I will be recused from the approval of the minutes for A. And then, since I was not in attendance, and then I will also, I It's up to board staff how they want to handle it. I was not present for the conversation on 6D for those applications, but I did review them. But I'm happy to just recuse if that's cleaner on 6D as well.
Ms. Galvin or Ms. Packer?
Yeah, Dr. Davey, if you have reviewed them, you could go ahead and vote.
Thank you. Then I'll go ahead. So I just need to be recused from the minutes from the July 8th meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Mr. Wynn?
I left at 12:45 on the July 8th meeting, so I guess I need to be recused as well.
So I think on item 6A, we will not have a quorum. Maybe we'll need to agendize it for the next meeting. On the remaining items, I think other than the recusals, because we'll probably have to take them together, different people are recusing on different things. I'll make a motion to approve the remaining items on the consent agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Stanhoff. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So then what's remaining is 6F? No. I'm sorry, can you remind me which one? There was a recusal.
G.
Thank you. So on 6G, I'll make a motion to approve the request for extension of time.
Second.
Second by Mr. Nguyen. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries and the recusals are as noted. Anything else we need to take from the consent agenda? All right. So then we'll skip number 7 because that's a timed item. Ms. Pakkinen, what should we take next?
Mr. Chair, we can do item 10, the psychologist application matters, if Dr. Seidemann and Dr. Catarino are available. Also, I think at the top of our queue would be the items at 8 and 9. So we can really take those in any order you'd like.
Okay, excellent. So let's go to number 10 because I saw Dr. Seidemann and Dr. Catarino nodding. Yes. So discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding psychologist applications forwarded from the application review committee to the board for substantive review. The first item is Julie Curley, PhD, FAIR, ECCC, and licensure. On this, Dr. Seidemann is the lead, so he will get us started.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I'd be happy to. Dr. Curley submitted an application for examination and licensure. Excuse me. And the application review committee has referred this application to the full board for discussion, consideration, and possible action due to some concerns that we have around Dr. Curley's internship not meeting the requirements. Due to several conflicting pieces of information provided by the applicant and their pre- and postdoctoral supervisor. The primary issue that we're having in the ARC is the way Dr. Curley was compensated for primarily her pre-doctoral internship. And what I'd like to do is have the board review R426209. C1. And give me 1 second, please, as I get my thoughts together here. R426209C states payment between a supervisor and supervisee. A supervising psychologist may pay a monetary stipend or fee to a supervisee if the amount paid by the supervisor is not based on the supervisee's productivity or revenue generated by the supervisee. The board staff received information from Dr. Curley's supervisor related to how they were compensated. And we had asked for additional information, and Dr. Quaino from Grandis Health came to speak with us at our ARC meeting this past week. And the supervisor had responded, quote, "While the manual may appear to be at odds with AAC R4-26209C, the compensation fees in place are not dependent upon the intern's productivity or revenue generated by the intern. This is due to the payment to the intern being in place regardless of payment received from any outside sources related to the intern contact." It goes on and says that the payment is not tied to productivity as related to notes or reports generated or the company's ability to bill for these services. This payment for the internship should therefore be viewed as a fee or stipend and not merit-based. Dr. Quaino attempted to explain this further because the ARC wasn't clear on what this actually meant. And we still have a concern, so we're bringing this to the board. It appears that the intern was paid for direct client contact, and that doesn't meet the rule as stated in by our laws. So that's why we're bringing the case to the board, and we'd like to discuss this with you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. So my question, and I'll open it for questions for Dr. Seidman, and then take it from there. But do we have records of the payroll receipts? Because that might, if there are fluctuations, then that might show that it's compensation that doesn't meet our rule requirements. But if it's just a constant, same payroll amount every 2 weeks or every whatever the payroll period is, then that would indicate otherwise.
I see Dr. Curley raising her hand. Thank you, Chairman Dine. That's a great suggestion, and that was kind of our next step.
Dr. Curley.
Hi, Dr. Cuneo is back on here. She can answer further questions. I did bring her back. So any of the other questions that you have, she is on here. So Mr. Chair, if you want to call her out, Dr. Cuneo is here.
Yes, I would like that. Thank you. Dr. Cuneo, if you're here, please unmute yourself, and I'm sure you heard the question.
She is on here somewhere.
Sorry, I'm having trouble unmuting and undoing my video. Hello, Chair and Dr. Seidman and members of the board. I had gone through, and our client contact hours was an arbitrary number that we used just so we could gauge when interns were doing full-time internship or part-time internship. It does not have to do with productivity of the office. It has to do, that number was a gauge of achievement in their internship and how many hours, because of the percentages that are used for the state of Arizona, for the individual universities. And we had found that we thought that would be the good gauge for where the intern is and how much they had put towards their internship, not towards our productivity. And my argument here is we can go through and try and find records for you to show that this was a standard amount. I believe Dr. Curley went part-time. She might want to jump in on this one for part of the internship, but then was back. So we had steady numbers. So we will be able to show that. But the reason that I am asserting that it's not tied to productivity is because we are a largely forensics practice. So it is not just client contact hours. It is based on things like reports, lots of things outside of client contact. The overlap of me being in session or not being in session with the client, or the intern coming into a session with me, that is not productivity on their part, but it counts as a client contact hour. It was geared towards more of a maximization of the training than towards the productivity of the company. It was all about trying to make sure that we could track where the interns were on their internship. I will change whatever wording is necessary to show that we are not exploiting the interns here and using them for productivity or paying them, you know, as tied to if you do more hours, you'll get more pay, anything like that. Because again, there were so many times that they would have client contact and it was not productive to the company to have the intern there with me or me there with them later on. But I'm thinking what I heard right before I had keyed up was that we're looking to show that the stipend was a steady amount and not she quote unquote worked with clients 3 hours this week. And so you get paid for 3 hours this week. And that should not be an issue at all. We should be able to do that. If anyone has any questions.
Thank you, Dr. William. Questions, Dr. Seidman.
I don't know if it's a question, it's more of a reaction, I think. Thank you, Dr. Cuneo, for that explanation. That's a bit more helpful. It sounds like that would be supervision hours then because they were in with you and you were doing training. So that makes a lot of sense. And so it's not direct client contact.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there. Yes, that is exactly. And now that we are having this discussion, I think that is what would need to be changed in our training manual, that it would not be worded as client contact hours. I'm not sure whether it's client supervision hours, because I think some of the schools clarify time that's spent in with the client while you're doing supervision, and then your outside review when you're doing all your case review things. So, but I'm not sure if client supervision hours
That'd be like direct observation, I think, is what you're describing.
Yes. And is that, but I don't know if that, I'm hoping that doesn't look like, again, quote unquote, work tie to the, okay. So really it should be more client supervision hours. And the client. Actuality client contact, but that I am there, they are there. We're not double billing for it. It has nothing to do with the output of the intern at the time. There's nothing we're using to assess how far progress is being made in terms of the internship.
I think for people who are listening to this conversation, which again, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts here. Pre-doctoral internship and postdoctoral residencies are clinical training opportunities for people pre-licensure. And all of the hours should be training and not based on productivity. And that's really what we as a board are supposed to be monitoring for trainees. So when they apply for licensure, they're prepared for independent practice. And so all of the documentation, including total hours and supervision hours and direct and indirect hours, need to be documented accurately and organized so it's very clear to the board that people meet the application requirements.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Dr. Carino.
So would we be able to get from the chart, the graph, how many hours were put in per week? How many hours were put in the week of September 3rd to 10th and the pay for that week or 2 weeks or monthly? Would we be able to get something like that so we could see that, they were consistent month or week by week? And if so, when could we receive these documents?
So actually, Dr. Curley, I'm going to jump in on this one. I am sure that Dr. Curley has some documentation on her end, but I would be able to go through. Would it be more helpful to have, I'm only thinking because there were some weeks when, I'm sure it happened with Dr. Curley, where people have off. I believe there may have been a medical issue in the middle of the internship. Would it be more helpful to show consistency month to month or week to week, or how what's the best way to show that?
How was Dr. Curley compensated? Every 2 weeks, every month, every week?
It was every week. There may have been some inconsistencies in there where it ended up being like every 2 weeks, which then caught up. But I believe it was in every week. So I don't know whether it's more convenient, only because, again, if there were times that were off or that we weren't in contact with each other, to show that the consistency is there, the amounts are the same, but that it may have come, I don't know, 3 or 4 days later or something like that.
I would like to see, you know, here's the check that was received for this time period, these are the hours worked. And I think, you know, you could write notes. This was a week that she was very ill, so that's why we only have 10 hours or no hours this week, mm-hmm. or something like that. And I, you know, the other thing you've mentioned a few times is when we are, it's not client contact when we do reports, yes, but it's still could be looked at productivity because it's a part, it's work for a specific client. So I just wanted to comment on that. But I wholeheartedly agree with Dr. Seidman that, you know, this is a training opportunity and, it, you know, it's not to really, you know, increase the income of the supervisor extensively. So we just want to be sure that's what's happening. So thank you. When would we receive these documents so we could make a decision?
I luckily do not have my own client okay. contact hours today, so I can work on this and see how fast I can get it over. I would love to tell you end of day today, but I know there's going to be some banking thing. So I'm going to say within the next few business days.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
So almost immediately.
Thank you, Dr. Cudio. Dr. Curley.
My question is this. I mean, I understand the board has all of these concerns, and hearing them from an outside source, I would be concerned as well. My concern, just for my own personal selfishness, is that other of my colleagues have gone through under this exact same contract already and have already tested. And I guess I'm wondering, why am I kind of stuck on the fire? You know, I've had so many of my other colleagues already go through under this exact same contract, and I feel like I'm almost, it's almost like prejudicial for some reason against me. I mean, I get it. I mean, if I'm sitting in this board meeting, I'm going, whoa, I get it. But at the same time, I'm watching my colleagues, one of them has already tested and unfortunately failed. You guys already put somebody through as early or as recent as last week under the same contract. I'm confused. Why am I stuck?
Dr. Katerina?
Well, one of the things is the committee composition changes. So it may be that we caused this, Dr. Seidman and I, at this meeting, but I may not have been present, or he may not have been on the committee at the other times they went through. And we just are human, and sometimes part of us catch things that some other people may not. There was, to be honest with you, there was some attention paid to your application. We looked close. I looked closely because there were so many different hours to begin with. And so I started wondering what was going on, why they were. And then I think I read it more closely, maybe because it was so confusing.
Yeah. Okay.
Dr. Cunha.
Yes, I was just going to say, while I can message Dr. Curley outside of the meeting, I wanted to make sure that it made it part of the public record. I believe it was because of the hour issues that we were having with Meditrek. And I completely understand that too, because I was signing off on these things also. So I was in there with Dr. Curley of what was happening with the hours, and that's, I would look more closely at it also. Yeah. Once we finally got all of the hours figured out and we reconciled everything with the school and were able to come up with, you know, hours that showed that she was actually in and had, I believe it was an entire extra quarter of school, that then, yes, now we, you know in the future, one, to double check our outside hour system, but also to be very on it with the applications so mm-hmm. that we can prove that all of our interns are going through, that they are getting the standard that they need to get in both the training and in providing care.
Thank you. Dr. Seidman?
Sorry, a quick comment. I appreciate the comments that have just been presented. And to piggyback on Dr. Catarino's comment, not only the hours that have been confusing, but the start and end dates of training. So pre-doctoral internship is a separate training program than a postdoctoral internship. And a job is very different than a pre-doctoral internship or a postdoctoral training. So it's very important for the public to know that as a supervisor, that we have that structure in place so licensees, when they apply, don't run into some of these troubles and confusion for them. And it's very clear start and end dates, hours, supervision hours, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you, Chairman Dyer.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. So I guess we will wait for the timesheets and the payroll records or payslips. Then I think, is there any further discussion or a motion? I think then it, at least like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Seidman and Dr. Catarino, it goes back to the ARC with that additional information. And then I think, from what we have heard, it should be straightforward to do a comparison, and it will probably come up back to the board on a consent agenda at a future date.
But I think if everything is clear and we can make a decision, I think we would make it there, and then it would be on the consent agenda. That we really had a lot of questions here, so we wanted to bring it to the full board.
Ms. Galvin.
If I may, because the committee has already taken a look at that, I think ARC has determined that the hours, everything else is in play, is appropriate. The only issue was, the stipend and whether it was linked to productivity. Given that, and that the board has requested, payroll information, payment information, that information, I think if the board is willing, could come directly back to the board for review. And then we're not missing yet another month where we'd have to go back to ARC and then back to the board.
Dr. Seidman?
Ms. Galvin, can I ask a question around that? I don't know if the other items are in place because there's been additional information provided and it's further confusing. It's different. And
okay, very good. That sounds like it's remand to the ARC is appropriate.
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion or motion?
I don't see how it would be much longer because we would still, if we went to the ARC and then the next week we would be going to the board, either way we would come to the board. So that's all. I was confused on how it would extend the time. So.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the ARC meets, a little bit before the board meeting. So, timeline-wise, it will come back to the next board meeting going through ARC. So any discussion or motion?
So it's my understanding the only thing you need are the timesheets from Dr. Cuneo?
And the pay.
Right.
Coordinating the pay and hours.
Right. So you don't need anything from me, just from Dr. Cuneo, correct?
Well, I think if you work together, if she doesn't have something and you
right.
have something, that's
right. Okay, great. Thank you.
Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we shouldn't make this, a formal request. So the documentation of that is clear. I mean, everyone's hearing the same thing. And I think there's, that clarity. But for purposes of memorializing, these the sequence of events, I'm recommending and suggesting a fair if Ms. Galvin concurs.
Yes. I
see Ms. Galvin concurring, and yes, Dr. Catarino.
Mr. Chair, committee board members, this is Kathy. I have a question. Dr. Seidman, did you have any concerns about the postdoc verification to add to this?
The recent materials that were sent in are still confusing and incomplete, if that's what you're asking, Kathy.
Yes, I in order to save time so that all things could be addressed at the ARC meeting, I wondered if you wanted to discuss that a little bit so that we can add it to the FAIR.
Sure, we can do that.
Simply for the record to state what the actual issues are.
Yes. If you could give me 1 second, please. So on the latest submittal that by Dr. Cuneo on July 30th of 2024, on the supervised psychology internship verification form, the dates are not accurate. So you'd want to take a look at that. On the supervised psychology internship training verification form, the dates don't match up with the pre-doctoral internship. So pre and postdoc dates don't match up correctly. And the number of hours of experience on the postdoctoral form are the exact same numbers as direct client contact. And that's one of the issues we were discussing earlier. So you'll want to take care of that as well. And then there was no response on section B, number 1 through 3. And there's no signature on page 2 of this, of two pages. So there's a number of things that you'll want to take a look at to correct. And that's why I suggested we bring it back to ARC. And that's, again, feeding into this idea of it was not a structured training program that met our requirements for licensure. Was that what you're asking for, Kathy? I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. I needed that in order to be able to put it into the FAIR letter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Folks, and thank you, Dr. Seidman. Any further discussion or motion?
It's not a motion to go back to FAIR, for FAIR, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do we need a motion? I see Ms. Galvin saying yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
Okay. So maybe I'll attempt to make a motion. I'll say maybe, you know, given today's discussion, we are formally requesting that additional documentation be provided to the board. This matter will be referred back to the application review committee to decide the next steps based on that additional documentation when it is received.
Second
by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you, Dr. Curley, and thank you, Dr. Cuneo, for being here.
Thank you.
So then let's go to 10B, Bianca Jeffers, PsyD, licensure by waiver. And Dr. Seidman is recused from this item, and Dr. Caterina is the lead. So Dr. Caterina will provide us a summary.
And this is the key that reason why this is coming to the board is because Dr. Seidman is recused. So Bianca Jeffers graduated from Midwestern, APA accredited August 22. She had an APA internship of 2,000 hours. She has a practica of 1,700 hours. She was licensed in Wisconsin in March 24 after passing the EPPP. She has 2 references. She has the self-query form. So everything is there. It's just that we're a committee of 2, and with 1 person being recused, we can't really approve. So we needed to bring it to the full board. I didn't see any concerns with this applicant at all.
Thank you, Dr. Catarino. Any discussion or motion?
I'd like to make a motion that we approve Bianca Jeffers' application for licensure by waiver.
Second.
There's a motion and a second by Dr. Davey. I also heard Dr. Stewart, but I'll give it to Dr. Davey. And any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. So then, number eight, Ms. Pakkanen, is that where you would lead us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, let's go to eight.
Okay. So number eight is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation from the Committee on Behavior Analysts to open an investigation into Kara Rupo for possible unlicensed practice. And on this item, Dr. Stenhoff is the lead, and he'll summarize the recommendation for us. Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Committee on Behavior Analysts reviewed the application on June 28th of Jocelyn Vidal-Varez. We found during our review of the file that Kara Rupel was identified as providing supervision experience at a place in which Ms. Vidal Alvarez was employed. We found that during the time that the supervision was occurring, that Ms. Rupel was not licensed. So due to this, and because of the statute ARS section 32-2091.12 stating that it's a class 2 misdemeanor for a person who's not licensed pursuant to this article to engage in the practice behavior analysis, which also includes supervision. So the committee is forwarding this recommendation to the board that an investigation be opened concerning Kara Rupel's supervision and to determine whether she practiced in Arizona as a behavior analyst prior to being authorized with licensure to do so. So that ends my summary of this. And I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. Any questions for Dr. Stenhoff? Any discussion? So maybe as a discussion item, I'll say, I mean, based on the information that is given to us and based on what the committee looked at, I think it makes sense to open an investigation. It may turn out to be something. It may turn out to be nothing, but just open an investigation, go through our processes and see what happens.
Yeah, correct, Mr. Chair.
So any discussion or motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion. My motion is just that we open a complaint just to investigate the matter to determine whether there was unlicensed practice.
Second.
There's a second by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion passes. Ms. Pakkanen, should we go to number nine?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
All right. Number nine is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation from the Committee on Behavior Analysts to refer to the Behavior Analyst Certification Board information concerning the following BCBAs. I believe there is more than one, so we'll just take one at a time. The first one is 9A, Tara Marshall. On this, Dr. Davey is the lead. Dr. Davey, do you want to get started?
Yes, thank you very much. With regard to Tara Marshall, we have a situation where an applicant has tried to contact Ms. Marshall to be able to complete her application so that she could become a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Arizona. Through this process, the licensee was unable to gain a response from the supervisor. And as such, that is concerning to the committee and should be concerning to this board. As one, it hinders our ability to expedite or to adjudicate these licenses in a timely manner. It also creates barriers for the the soon-to-be licensee to be able to get their application complete, to get in front of the committee and therefore the board. Further, our code of ethics as behavior analysts compels individuals that are supervisors to follow state licensing board's rules and regulations and to respond to requests for information in a timely manner. There are further rules that relate to the responsibilities of a supervisor as well in our field, and that is the standard of care across the United States and for behavior analysts. And so because of that, I move that we go ahead and update the Behavior Analytics Certification Board to look into possible violations of their code by this behavior analyst. And that is a motion.
Second. There's a second by Dr. Stewart. Discussion? I think as a discussion item, makes sense to me what Dr. Davis said. It's a referral, and then, you know, it's up to them to see what happens.
Yes, and as this point of discussion, this has occurred now more times than I care to admit as a behavior analyst, and this has been our path pretty, you know, consistently as a committee and then as a board to do this.
Any more discussion? So there's a motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you.
So the 9B is Amanda Shivera. Apologize if I'm mispronouncing. And Dr. Davy, again, up to you.
Thank you. This is the exact same situation where an individual who's not licensed in the state that we do not have jurisdiction over has failed to respond to someone seeking licensure in this state. Again, running afoul of standard of care and practice that is upheld by our certification board and expected by this licensing board. Similar circumstances where the licensee's completed application was slowed down because of non-contact and non-responsiveness, and ultimately slowed it down getting it all the way through to the full board's approval. So much like the other one, my recommendation is that we refer this matter over to the Behavior Analyst Certification Board for them to look at possible violations of the Ethics Code for Behavior Analysts. And that is my motion.
Second.
All right. There is a motion by Dr. Davy and second by Dr. Stewart. Any discussion?
No further discussion this time. Very similar to the previous case in that this is standard response to a failure by a supervisor that is not in our jurisdiction to move this forward to the national certifying body.
Very well. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Ms. Pakkanen, where to next?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to recommend that we continue with behavior analyst items and move to number 12.
Number 12, very good. Number 12 is discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning potential revisions to Admin Code R4-26-406. Ms. Pakkanen, will you please provide a summary?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The board, I believe, received a brief update relative to this matter earlier this year. This has been on the radar of the Committee on Behavior Analysts for several months as well. Essentially, what we realized was that when a respondent's attorney called to our attention some concerns with how our 426-406 ethical standard for behavior analysts, how that language, rule language, was adopted, what it failed to do, which means it's out of compliance with ARS 41-1028. What it fails to do is it fails to cite a specific version of the BACB ethical code. It could be construed to, you know, consider or acknowledge multiple versions of the code, and that doesn't seem to be meet the requirements of the statute in Title 41. Curiously, this rule was approved by the Governor's Regulatory Review Council, but that a stakeholder, I guess, brought it to our attention, you know, means and there's acknowledgement about the problem with the rule. There's a need to address this issue, and that can only be done, you know, through a rulemaking to correct it. So the committee did last week during its meeting decide to forward a recommendation to the board to incorporate by reference what is the most current version of the BACB ethical code. And I think that Dr. Davis Wilson, who is a valued stakeholder with a great deal of perspective, we heard her comments during the call to the public, and I can speak to, I think I can speak to all of them, and perhaps in the process allay at least some of them, or, you know, find a way for this to move forward in some fashion. So if you'd like me to address those, I certainly can.
Yes, please, Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you. So what I understand to be the case, you know, through my my time in promulgating rules, is that really what's essential here is that any member of the public needs to be able to read that rule and understand specifically which document it is that the board enforces. So we can compose this rule language to be reflective of a version of the Code of Ethics that was adopted or enacted, whatever language the organization uses. And we can also, in the process, acknowledge an update associated with that enactment or adoption. So we do have some latitude there, I think, to address at least that concern that, that Dr. Davis Wilson raised. We just need to be careful and comprehensive where that language is concerned. I will speak to the extraordinary capability of the contract rule writer that we use and explain, you know, the circumstances to her. And together we can arrive at, I think, what would be proposed language that signals to the public that there's no ambiguity to the public, you know, what we're talking about. So I think that can be achieved. So I'm not certain that the committee needs to take this up again. I just think we need to put this in the capable hands of our rule writer. And, you know, again, what's important is that any member of the public who wants to understand which version are you talking about? It's easily traceable from our rule language and what our rule states to the document itself. Also, we have an obligation according to the rule to provide the correct copy to any member of the public who requests it. So as long as we achieve clarity, and, you know, that's the objective that we meet, then I think there's a solution that we can arrive at just with well-crafted language. And I'll pause there because I see Dr. Stewart has a question.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Again, my understanding is that the rules and statutes are static for the most part, whereas revisions of ethical codes are fluid. For instance, with the APA, I think our board has adopted, what, the 2013 APA ethical code as our formatted anchor. And so it doesn't have to be the latest revision. It just has to be one that's reasonable to the body politic or the stakeholders in of that profession. So I would be quite happy if Dr. Davey and Dr. Davis Wilson would and the other behavior analysts would get together and just choose the best version that they decide might be workable, and then just use that as our anchor, as our foundation for the statute, for the rules.
Thank you for that comment. Yes, so any state agency that is authorized by statute to adopt rules, to promulgate rules, you're correct, can point to any version that they determine is in the best interest of protecting the public. So if there was a version that was adopted or enacted in 1908, and, you know, that's what the board determined was the best enforcement, tool where ethical conduct is concerned, that's what can be in the rule. Absolutely. It's not uncommon for boards to be behind, to not necessarily keep pace with adoption of new ethical codes. I think Dr. Davis Wilson, she's absolutely correct in that, there's sort of a struggle with this younger emerging profession to maintain awareness of, how to comply not only with their certification requirements and the ethical code that the BACB represents and enforces, but also with their licensure board requirements. So there, we have to acknowledge there's going to be a challenge anytime they are not in perfect alignment, but it is not uncommon for boards to have to be behind. And if they choose to try to chase or catch up or keep pace to new versions. So I do want to speak to Dr. Davis Wilson is so gracious when, she acknowledges that, board staff, we have, we're managing an awful lot of responsibilities, but this is one that I can gratefully assigned to our contract rule writer, who is, her capabilities, there's no one else in the state of Arizona with her set of capabilities. So I'm confident that we can work together and minimize the level of effort that I need to put forth. We did budget for rulemaking for this fiscal year because we saw this coming and perhaps some other rule writing, where the psychologist rules are concerned. So from a time and resources perspective, I'm not worried. I feel like we can move forward with this and, not feel an enormous impact. We have to acknowledge that we may get this rule into place, and then within a short time frame, the BACB is working on yet another update to their code. They do this with more frequency than I think a lot of other associations that they revisit and potentially update their codes. So the BACB is always going to challenge us, to try to keep pace as best as we can. But if we fall behind, then, it's not a fatal error in that instance, but we can remain as committed as possible to try to be as nimble as we can, to do the best, best possible, pacing, as the BACB, adopts new versions on what I understand to be a 5-year cycle.
I saw Dr. Davies' hand up.
Thank you. Is it possible for me to share my screen, Jennifer Heidi? I just wanted to pull up the code and I think maybe highlight kind of where some of the discussion around which version is accepted. And I think it might be useful for the whole group to see.
Dr. Devi, Krishna Poe is the host. So if she goes to the share button at the bottom, there is, she should see, find a setting that enables screen sharing for participants. So Ms. Poe, are you able to find that?
Yes, I believe it's set right now and Dr. Devi should be able to share, but let me know if that's not the case, Dr. Devi.
Thank you.
I think I'm sharing. So I think one of the things that will be interesting just for this for the board to understand is that we have, this is the most recent version pulled right from the website. It's live right this second from the BACB. And so what you have is this code went into effect on this date. But what you'll find is that prior to that date, this had already been published. This document was out in the wild for everybody to see and to kind of get prepared for starting in 2020. And so the actual reference to the most recent code is the Behavior Analyst Certification Board 2020. That would be the document that they say this is how this should be referenced. However, things happen in the BAC, in the world of BACB, and as you said, that there are updates and it's much more fluid. So you'll see on their website that there's been some edits already to this one that's come out. And here is a good example of that. They added a definition of what dissent is, and they updated the version in September of 2021. That update is included in this document here. And is still referenced as such, Behavior Certification Board 2020 Ethics Code of Behavior Analysts. That was a major change that was outlined by the BACB on its website. But you will see here that there's been updates as, you know, just 6 months ago to things that were not as critical. Maybe they found a typo. Maybe there was a registered trademark missing. And so they still have the copyright of the 2020, but they've added this updated version, right? And so I think what I think is important for our rulemaker to understand is that kind of progression of things, right? That there is this, there is the we'll say the master document, and that master document may get modified in the course of 2 to 4 years while this particular copyright version is alive to make sure it's keeping up, staying fluid with the things that are out there impacting our field. But then at some point, there is going to be another version, and it's probably on the website, that says when the next version that will be copyrighted and put out is going to be made available. So maybe that's in 2025, 2026. And at some point, then our documentation, our reference will need to change to the code that is copyrighted in 2025 or 2026. And so I just think it's important for just as a visual for you all to kind of see what we're trying to tackle, if you will, that Ms. Packman's trying to get her arms around. And so I'll stop sharing and thank you for allowing me to do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Devi. And this is, I think, an important insight. So thank you, Ms. Packman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I agree entirely. I think Dr. Davies sort of guided tour of the document is really helpful. And I think what he has achieved is essentially, you know, better clarifying what I was trying to explain earlier, which is as long as the rule language appropriately cites what happened in 2020, what happened in 2022. I mean, in other words, the language, it's easily, any member of the public could trace what the language does in terms of, you know, identifying the code that's enforced, trace it back to the specific document. So I say, let's put this in the very skilled and capable hands of Ms. Jeannie Han, our rule writer. I will work closely with her to make sure that, you know, the language is so comprehensive that no one should be misguided when reading our rule. So that was just sort of my impressions.
Thank you, Ms. Packen. And as a discussion item, I have a few sort of thoughts on this. I mean, I generally appreciate the stakeholder who brought this matter to our attention. I like when, you know, stakeholders come forward with identifying things for us, and then we can sort of, you know, put our thoughts together on how to address those issues. I also appreciate Dr. Davis Wilson coming and giving her insights to us. For me, the concern really is the statute, the incorporation by reference statute that's in our materials and in the memo that Ms. Pakkanen prepared. And that really sort of, like, I guess, for lack of a better expression, closes the deal for me. It says, you know, there are specific things that need to be mentioned in the rule. You have to give the location, like a website address. You have to give like a specific version of the rule that is adopted. And you can't, and any, if there are any amendments to the ethics code, let's say by the drafting authority, then those can be incorporated, but you have to go through a brand new rulemaking to incorporate them. So, I mean, that's, we are pretty much sort of like stuck with the clear instructions that we have received from the legislature. Okay, this is how we do things. And, you know, I understand sort of, you know, different people might have different preferences as to, well, you know, we are, there is more of a flux with this particular profession because it's a newer profession. So they are updating their ethics code more frequently. But then that just means, you know, if the new update, if the new update is substantive and we think that's the best code that's out there, we just have to go through a rulemaking to update our rules that incorporates that document by reference. So I am in support, broadly speaking, of the efforts of updating our rules to comply with the statutory language. Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And depending on the board's motion, if the motion is, you know, to move forward, you know, to revise the rule, the board will, of course, get to see this language again. So you can even, you know, raise questions, of course, to me. We could bring Ms. Han in, you know, if you have questions for her when you review the proposed draft language. So it will come back to you and you'll have, you know, one, at least one opportunity to take another look at it. And just by way of reminder, and maybe just for the public's benefit, this is a multi-step process. We will have to first request approval from the governor's office, which that may just be a matter of the turnaround of a few days, especially because, you know, this is a very straightforward and simple request. The request would sound like this. You know, we need to revise this rule to comply with the statute. And so, you know, that to me wouldn't particularly be controversial. So once that approval is received, the drafting will take mere minutes. You know, there's other documents that Ms. Ham will have to prepare that accompany that. So that will be a little bit more effort, but you may see this in, if not September, in October, I predict, you know, it could be relatively quickly when you sort of get, you know, one more opportunity to say, that's the language that we want to propose.
Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pakkanen, just also thinking as time kind of goes out, right, like we know that there's the potential, there's going to be a bill introduced by stakeholders to rerun this idea of a co-located board for behavior analysts under psychologists. AZIAB has already made that publicly acknowledged that effort is coming. Would it make sense also to work with them to talk about and maybe reach out to the BACB about potential changes that are coming? Perhaps there's going to be a new version that's going to be copyright 2025. And that while we're doing our things to clean up this time that's going to go between now and let's just say this co-located board gets approved and all the rules and statutes or all the rules are promulgated, in that time frame, I would just encourage us to work with the with the group that's working on that language to maybe incorporate the next version. Maybe by then the BACB will have a date of which the copyright will occur or the effective date. And that way, maybe we capture two of these, right? We capture the current issue right now, but then we're also ahead of the game because we know we're going to get a chance to have some rules because of the potential for a co-located board.
Ms. Pakkanen?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, Dr. Davey, Dr. Davis-Wilson, I think have both, you know, sort of are looking toward the future, albeit, you know, an uncertain one. But nonetheless, there will need to be some close coordination, you know, in a very global and comprehensive sense. So there will, the statute language that is, you know, potentially enacted that establishes a separate board. Should that happen, there will be, I presume, some session law language in there that sort of addresses the fact that the R426, well, Article 4, the entire Article 4 will need to be packed in a suitcase and moved, you know, in the sense to that, to the, under the authority of the new agency. So there'll be a statutory mechanism to achieve that. And then I absolutely am anticipating and will request, you know, the funding to support what will probably be a pretty substantial rulemaking effort because of what is a monumental set of statutory changes. So, and there will be an effective date for the establishment of any future independent behavior analyst board, right? So there will be some opportunity for us to say, okay, we know what language we're going to be working with. And even though it isn't effective until, I'll make up a date, July 1 of 2026, July 1, 2027, whatever that date is, you know, we have to gather the resources and make the effort in the meantime to make sure those rules all align with the new statute language and reflect what it is that, you know, this constituency wants to represent in its rules. So that's going to be a pretty big effort, but I'm already anticipating, you know, what that encompasses.
Any more discussion? Maybe Dr. Stenhoff has some thoughts since this is a behavior analyst issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the big concern I have is just kind of pulling us back into the upcoming changes. I like Dr. Stewart's idea of just kind of locking in on one, but I think we're going to have ongoing issues with the changes. And especially, it seems like we have an ongoing conversation with the BACB from the CBA and from the board. So both of those occurring and having kind of matching ethics that we are tied to as a state board, but also tying to our national certifying board. So those are just some concerns I think that we can, you know, figure out, but just concerns that I do have. So thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So I think Ms. Pakkanen, you need a motion from us or just direction to staff, or how do you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, a general motion to move forward with just so the record reflects, you know, the clarity that I think we need in terms of, you know, what version of the code are we talking about, and leaving the details, you know, to the finer details to our rule writer to ensure that what is proposed, you know, again, points to exactly what version we mean. So let's have the motion, you know, reflect that and sort of acknowledge in the process, you know, that this is what you're authorizing me to do, is to move forward to the governor's office and then shepherd, you know, this proposed change through the drafting process for the board to review at a future date. Does that make sense? Did I make sense?
So moved.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. I was going to say, you know, Ms. Pakkanen said it better than I could have. So yeah. Thank you for moving.
Second.
So true.
Second by Dr. Stenhoff. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
I see Ms. Poe has her hand up.
Oh, I didn't see that because I don't see non-video participants. Sorry, Ms. Poe, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, no, it's fine. After the vote, I was going to give the next CE code word.
Okay, then let's run the motion and then we'll get back to you, Ms. Poe. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Ms. Poe, and then I see Dr. Davis Wilson's hand up. Ms. Poe, would you want to give the code word?
Yes, the first CE code word is backpack. Backpack. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. And Dr. Davis Wilson, I'll allow it just because, you know, we respect you a lot and, you know, we want your insights. So please go ahead.
I appreciate it. And I just wanted to make a comment. One, thank you for allowing me to speak, but then also for taking into consideration some of the points that I brought up. I think that my biggest one was making sure that Dr. Davy was able to be a part of the conversation in that capacity, because he does have the knowledge of how the BACB operates in kind of those movements. You had mentioned that the ethics code has to be located on a website. I just wanted to make sure that you guys, I don't know if that can be your guys' website, but I wanted to make sure that you guys were aware that the BACB does not keep those historical versions on their website the same way that the APA does. And so you may want to, as you're working through this, either have the conversation with the BACB, or if you can put it on your guys' website, that would be sufficient. I just wanted to let you guys know that some of those historical documents, the BACB does not keep as public documents.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Ms. Pakkanen?
Yes, and I appreciate that explanation very much, because I've been a little frustrated that I couldn't necessarily find those documents. So the rule would allow for two opportunities for the public to access the document, either from the source itself, but we too have an obligation to provide it. So I'll make sure that, you know, we maintain that as a record, a permanent record, as long as, you know, the rule cites to it. So, you know, we can fulfill our obligation to supply it if anyone requests it. So I'll commit to that.
I believe you're muted, Mr. Diner.
You know, it happened once, right? Sorry. I was saying we have about half an hour before the timed item, and I want to take a break around 10 o'clock for occupational safety and health reasons at some point. So maybe if there's an item we can fill in about 10, 15 minutes, that would be my preference. Ms. Pakkanen, what's your suggestion?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure this is a 10 or 15 minute discussion, but it will fill at least a portion of the time. I think what staff is trying to do, we're trying to, you know, to the extent that's possible and practical, give Dr. Medina, when she joins the meeting, you know, an opportunity to be involved in some of the agenda items that are specific to psychologist practice. So really, the item 14, the annual meeting discussion, that's the only time filler that that we have before, you know, we sort of have to turn to psychologist matters.
Okay. Dr. Caterina.
I know that Dr. Medina is on 13. I'm on that too. And that could be just a couple, 5 minutes or so if you wanted to use that time to
that's
say.
True. We could do 14 and half of 13.
Okay. So let's go to 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding board member and staff participation in the ASPPB's annual meeting of delegates, which will be held on October 30th through November 3rd, 2024 in Dallas, Texas. And Ms. Pakkanen, will you please provide an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I always regret that I'm, you know, these decisions have to sort of be made. too far in advance, really, for us to have all the clarity that we would want to have, you know, relative to the meetings, the topics, you know, the content and so forth. But at any rate, we are expected as a member jurisdiction to send a delegate member to this annual meeting, and the dates are provided. They consist of not, I think it's encompassing the first day of meetings, which are really just for the board chair, board chairs who attend, and board administrators. But roughly the dates are October 30 through November 3. The meeting location is in Dallas, Texas. So I think the board, it will come as no surprise that we don't have the funding this year. I as much as said that last month. You know, we've had the luxury in, you know, recent years of sort of being able to send, you know, two, three, even I think four members, which that's a reflection of, you know, sort of giving particularly new board members an opportunity to, you know, learn and experience from a bigger and deeper perspective about, you know, regulation of psychologist practice. So, you know, it really is a unique and valuable experience. And it's infrequent. There's really an opportunity only twice a year. So, what we can do at this time is we can afford to send two people, one of whom would be, carry the responsibility, be assigned the responsibility of being the delegate member. That there are some cost savings, not much, but cost savings. There's some of that is funded by ASPPB. Typically, and I'm still, again, waiting for some clarity with some, I'm usually a speaker on most agendas, so I may or may not have a portion of my travel covered if the board determines that that's who you're going to send. So, you know, I put this out to the board just for consideration, and I know you'll be thoughtful in terms of, you know, identifying, you know, the probably the one or two people that you need, that you feel needs to attend this meeting. Any questions for me?
Mr. Nguyen?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say, I think it was maybe last year or the year before. I can't even remember what I did last week, let alone a year ago. But I attended this meeting kind of as a new board member, in particular as a public serving member of the board. And I thought it was great. It was impactful. It gave me kind of a deep dive on everything that you guys live and breathe every day from the public side of things. So it was a great experience, except me getting sick on the back end and it being during Halloween every year. Still a very good experience. So I recommend it to another. I'm not volunteering myself. I think it'd be great if someone hasn't been, that they would go and experience something like that.
Yes, I second that, Mr. Nguyen. I'll say, based on what Ms. Pakkinen said, I think, you know, Ms. Pakkinen, you should be one of the people we send, and then as budget approves, one or two board members who are, again, I don't know Ms. Pakkinen how much provision we can make, but maybe we can, as a board, say up to two board members in addition to Ms. Pakkinen as the budget allows. Mm-hmm. And then maybe have some of the newer board members or whoever is interested sort of get back to you, Ms. Pakkinen, and express their interest in attending. Dr. Caterina?
Well, I did get to go to two meetings, and so I would say that I think it would be best if some of the newer people have that opportunity. Because, yes, it was very, very interesting and impactful, which you'll hear a little bit about in a minute, but I think that would be maybe Dr. Seidman, Dr. Flint, if they have the opportunity. Dr. Stenhoff might really enjoy this. Thank you.
Dr. Davey?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that I couldn't agree more that it's a great experience, and so those that have not gone should definitely be top of consideration. I would also put out there that if possible, depending on my travel schedule, I may be willing to attend and cover the costs of attendance and not take it out of the board budget. But I need to look at those dates around other obligations. And I know that we had spoken also, Ms. Backenown, about perhaps even doing a presentation. But again, I do not want to eat up any of the board funding, as I can piggyback a trip to Dallas on onto my real job, which has operations in Dallas. And so I can make that work.
So Ms. Packanen, do you need a motion or is that sufficient direction? I see Ms. Galvin saying yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I agree with Ms. Galvin. I think that the practice has, what I consider to be a best practice is that, you know, anytime we spend appropriated funds to send anyone out of state for a meeting, the public record should reflect that this was a, you know, thoughtful discussion. I heard a lot of board members provide, you know, articulate justification for, you know, why this is important, and so forth. And again, you know, just in light of the circumstances of the, you know, where all agencies are being called on to do, you know, more with less or more with the same, depending on the situation. And there is directive right now from the governor that the justification for the for any out-of-state travel needs to be mission critical. I would say that, you know, ASPPB, I wouldn't describe it as commands, you know, their members to attend, but we are expected as a member to send, you know, a representative again as a delegate. So that's the justification I will use. And I think the motion really, you know, sort of enhances that justification that I'll prepare.
Yeah, thank you. And in furtherance of that, I'll probably say, you know, that I think ASPPB is sort of intertwined with the board's functions of protecting the public quite a lot. I mean, we, you know, they are the examination sort of body, and you know, they have very good insights and you know, things for the board that are critical, really, for the board's mission. To protect the public and regulate the profession. So I think, you know, there's ample justification for having board members and, you know, the executive director and board staff budget permitting to attend ASPPB annual meetings. So I guess I'll make a motion that we approve the executive director and budget permitting up to two board members to attend the ASPPB annual meeting in Dallas, Texas.
Second.
There's a second, I think, by Dr. Stewart or Mr. Nguyen. Mr. Nguyen. Let's go with Mr. Nguyen. And any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, that brings us to 9:58 a.m. So I'll exercise my privilege to ask for a break. We'll come back at 10:15. Thank you. It's 10:15 a.m. and we are back in open session. Ms. Packanen, we did not have quorum for 6A. Do we have quorum now with Dr. Medina joining us?
We do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's go there then. So 6A was the consent agenda. I guess, Dr. Medina, are you recused from it?
No. I'm not recused.
Okay, then I make a motion to approve item 6A, which is the minutes of the previous meeting.
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, so it is time now for the timed item, 10:16 a.m. item number 7, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to the proposed findings of fact, proposed conclusions of law, and recommended decision by Judge Ted Wagon here for case numbers 24F2411 PSY and 24F2414 PSY. Regarding Nicole Huggins CID and issuance of a final decision, alternatively, consideration of a possible consent agreement presented by respondent. And for this item, we have legal representation for the board from Ms. Elizabeth Campbell of the Attorney General's office, and Ms. Galvin is representing the state of Arizona with respect to these matters. So let's keep them sort of separate in our minds. And is Dr. Huggins present? And I believe she has, she's represented by either Mr. Turk or Ms. Brianna Campbell.
Yes, Brianna Campbell appearing on behalf of Dr. Nicole Huggins this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. And because we have the board's attorney, who is also Ms. Campbell, I'll refer to the board's attorney as the board's attorney, and for Dr. Huggins' counsel as Dr. Huggins' counsel, and Ms. Galvin as Ms. Galvin, or the state's attorney. Just trying to keep all the parties clear and for the record.
Perfect.
So I think the first item we need to discuss is the respondents or Dr. Huggins' motion to continue. So we'll hear first from Dr. Huggins' counsel on the motion to continue.
Yes, perfect. So we had sent a letter dated July 30th to the board copying Ms. Mickelson. We were only retained in this matter just days ago. We were only made aware of this hearing, I believe, on Monday. We have not had adequate time to review the underlying record. However, our client has taken the position that she does not dispute the board's underlying suspension of her license, and in fact is willing to relinquish her license in Arizona altogether. What she would like is for the board to agree under ARS 41-1092.08I to agree to modify the language of the findings of fact and conclusion of law that will basically allow her to protect her reputation as she does hold a secondary license in another state. That subsection, 0.08 subsection I, does allow the board to modify their decision, and that triggers a 30-day timeline in which counsel can confer both with the board staff and opposing counsel and come to language that everyone can agree on. Otherwise, we will be forced to, of course, file an appeal and request a trial de novo as a matter of right, which we would really prefer to avoid just because it's costly and because our client is not actually disputing the underlying resolution to actually suspend her license. So that's all I have for you guys today. If you have any questions, I'm absolutely happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, then we'll hear from Ms. Galvin representing the state.
Good morning, members of the board. The state doesn't really take a position on whether to continue this matter, although I do agree with Ms. Brianna Campbell that you do have the ability to table the matter, allow the parties to meet and confer to see if there can be some agreement on the modification of the findings of fact. And I believe that would be as simple as notifying the Office of Administrative Hearings not to certify the decision because the parties are negotiating a final order. Other than that, the state takes no position whether the request should be continued or granted.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Galvin? All right, then I'll actually make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice and then possibly for discussing personal health information. Is there a second?
Dr. Dinar, this is Beth Campbell. Because there's sort of two different types of executive sessions and they have different Different people get to be in different ones. If the board could limit at least the first executive session to just legal advice, that would be my preference.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just do legal advice. And I suspect there'll be another executive session while we're discussing this matter. So this executive session will just be for legal advice pertaining to the motion to continue.
Second.
There is a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion carries. We're back in open session. On the table is a motion for continuance filed by Dr. Huggins. So that's what we're discussing. Any board member wants to start our discussion?
Before you start, I just want to add that my client, for the record, Dr. Huggins has now joined me. So she is in the meeting.
Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Huggins, for being here. We appreciate your attendance.
Sorry, I'm taking topic.
So discussion on the motion to continue. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Huggins has had ample opportunity to appear before this board. She also had an opportunity to appear in the administrative law judge hearing and apparently chose not to do those. I don't have an inclination to continue the matter at this 11th hour because she has decided to maybe change her mind or seek legal advice or something else. I'm just wondering. And again, we're in discussion, so it's not a question for Dr. Huggins to address. But with her lack of interest in defending her license all this time, I guess I'm not inclined to continue the matter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Dr. Stewart. I am not inclined to grant the continuance. I just don't. We've been at this since, what, December? There have been ample opportunity to do it here, you know, respond, follow. There was the hearing. I mean, I don't see a reason at this point to grant the continuance. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. As a matter of discussion, I'll say usually, I mean, when we see continuance requests, it's because of some sort of, some personal life emergency that occurs that necessitates a continuance. And, you know, we have taken that into account in previous times when we have granted continuances. Is, you know, during COVID times, there were some situations I can recall where we had granted continuances as a board, but the only reason that we heard for the continuance was really, you know, the statute allows us to sort of have a continuance and then have a meet and confer, but that right. Just citing the statute, yeah. Or just sort of, you know, somebody is not muted, so I'll encourage you to mute yourselves. So I don't see the reasons offered for continuance as enough to grant a continuance. So I'll maybe stop there and see if there is any further discussion.
If I could just add to kind of...
This isn't really the time, I'm sorry. We heard argument from both counsel. Any discussion from board members? Dr. Medina.
Oh, I was going to entertain a motion, pose a motion if it's a time, but I see Dr. Simon has his hand up. So
Maybe there is further discussion, so I will wait.
Okay, Dr. Seidman.
Just a quick comment. I think the reason we heard for the continuance was to save reputation in the state that Dr. Huggins is licensed in. And I don't see that as a valid reason for us to entertain the idea of a continuance either. So I just want to state for the record that I don't see a valid reason for a continuance.
Dr. Medina, back to you.
So I would like to then make my motion to deny the request for a continuance for this case.
There's a motion by Dr. Medina and a second by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So having denied the continuance, I think the next thing for us to do is consider the ALJ's recommended decision or consider a request to meet and confer. Is that correct, Ms. Elizabeth Campbell?
So the meet and confer provision is only triggered if the board intends to modify the ALJ's recommended findings of fact and conclusions of law or order. So that's not, the meet and confer doesn't have to happen. So I would recommend that the board sort of work its way down the through the findings of fact and conclusions of law and then order, and then we'll take it step by step.
Okay. Thank you. So at this time, you know, let's go through considering the ALJ's recommended decision. And for the record, I want all of the board members, I want to state for the record that all of the board members have been furnished with the administrative record of the formal hearing on this matter that happened in the Office of Administrative Hearings. Each of the board members will have to indicate when their name is called, whether they have read the hearing transcript. So Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll and we'll indicate. So if that's the indication.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar.
So I have read the hearing transcript and all of the record of the proceedings in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Thank you. Dr. Medina.
Yes. Can I just say yes, or do I have to make the full statement?
I think yes is acceptable.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
Yes, I have read the transcript of the administrative law judge.
Thank you. Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes, I've read all the materials.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Thank you. That is all board members who have not recused from the case.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So at this time, the board will hear a brief oral argument from the parties on the ALJ's recommended decision. Please keep in mind that this is not the time to re-argue the case. Please focus on the recommended penalty and any changes that you're requesting to the ALJ's recommended decision. Each party will have 5 minutes, but you know there's some wiggle room I'll allow. The state has the burden of proof in this matter and therefore shall present first. The state will be allowed some time for a brief rebuttal following the presentation from the from Dr. Huggins' counsel. Ms. Galvin, please proceed.
Good morning, Jean Galvin, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state. On July 23rd, the state filed its motion in support of the board adopting the recommended decision and order of the administrative law judge. That motion is on page 8 of your materials. The hearing was held on June 17th, 2024. Ms. Michelson testified on behalf of the state. We admitted some 14 exhibits. Dr. Huggins failed to appear at the hearing or participate. She was not represented by counsel. I have reviewed the recommend a decision and order. The findings of fact are accurate and supported by the evidence. The conclusions of law are justified based on those findings of fact. The administrative law judge recommended and affirmed the board's order summarily suspending Dr. Huggins' license, and she recommended that the board revoke Dr. Huggins' license. The state urges you to adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, affirming the summary suspension and revoking Dr. Huggins' license to practice psychology. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Dr. Huggins, counsel, you may proceed.
Yes, we'd start by saying that Dr. Huggins' failure to participate in the proceedings was in fact due to one of the most extreme family crises that I personally have heard in my career. Obviously, that was not allowed to be made part of the record at the time. There were also issues involving the mailing of the notices. Dr. Huggins, in fact, did not receive the notice of hearing. She was not in town at the time that it was mailed. There is evidence of that fact. We would ask that the findings of fact and conclusions of law be modified so as not to impugn her professional reputation and prevent her from continuing to practice outside the state of Arizona. Again, Dr. Huggins has made extremely clear that she has no objection to the actual revocation of her license in Arizona. She is not practicing and has not practiced due to the family crisis that I just mentioned in quite some time. We really cannot speak directly to every single finding of fact that is listed here, mostly because, again, this is on an uncontested record. However, were we to have leave to present additional evidence to the board, I can guarantee you that we can refute almost every single finding of fact that is presented in the ALJ's order. Unfortunately, because of the family crisis that I've mentioned several times, that wasn't able to be done in a timely fashion, and we do understand that. However, I would ask that the board grant us leave to present at least an additional brief with proposed language as to the findings of fact and conclusions of law that both parties can agree to, and that will provide the board with additional context for exactly what happened here. And I can guarantee you that it is a significant situation that I do think warrants the board's consideration. That's all I have for you.
Thank you. A question for you. Is there any, so there are 21 paragraphs of findings of fact. Are there any particular paragraphs that you want the board to modify at this time?
Yes. So paragraph one, again, the reference here is to unprofessional conduct. There really can't be a finding of unprofessional conduct without an understanding of the situation here. Now, Dr. Huggins did file a response in relation to the Bierman allegation, and I think you can see from the record before you that that allegation is fairly minor and certainly does not warrant a finding of unprofessional conduct. As to the second complainant, that is obviously Dr. Huggins' ex-husband. They're embroiled in an extremely contentious divorce where there has been allegations of extreme emotional and other abuse. That also led to multiple criminal filings on both sides, and those matters are actually continuing to this day. They are some of the most contentious proceedings that I personally have seen. I just want to state that any allegation that was alleged by Dr. Huggins' ex-husband should be viewed with extreme suspicion. He lacks any credibility. Really, his opinion here is incredibly biased. And I would say that even outside the fact that they are undergoing this very, very contentious litigation in both the criminal court, family court, two times, that is ongoing. So I think the findings of fact that stem from that complaint have to be modified to at least note that these are coming from an incredibly biased and just not credible, complainant at all, we would ask that they be stricken if possible. If not, we would ask that any single paragraph that mentions the word unprofessional conduct be taken out because of these extreme circumstances. And again, if there is an opportunity, we would actually like to present a modified order that goes paragraph by paragraph to the board. Unfortunately, because we were retained just days ago, we did not have time to confer with our client. At the same time, our client should not be punished for that. This is someone who is doing the best that they can, and I understand that you guys are mental health professionals. So I'm sure that you can understand that sometimes life gets in the way. And I would ask you guys to have empathy and compassion for the situation and to give her just time to actually respond in a fulsome way before we have to pursue an appeal and a trial de novo. If you have any further questions, I'm happy to ask. I'm happy to answer anything you have.
Any more questions for Dr. Huggins' counsel? Hearing none, let's go to rebuttal by Ms. Galvin.
Briefly, thank you, members of the board. First of all notices and communication, the interim order, were sent to Dr. Huggins at her last address of record as provided to the board, as well as her email. All of those communications were sent to the sent to her and not returned. The respondent's counsel seems to focus and all of her argument on the contentious divorce between the two. The final recommended decision of the ALJ, the complaints filed against and between the two played almost no part in the recommended decision. They were discussed and provided, and evidence was offered to give the ALJ context as to how we got here. The main thrust of the recommended decision and the state's case against Dr. Huggins focuses on the fact that she failed to comply with a board subpoena and she failed to comply with a board order to get a psychological evaluation completed. The unprofessional conduct was not so much about the complaints between her and her ex-husband and the allegations. The focus is her failure to comply with the subpoena. She failed to appear at the board meeting, and she also failed to comply with the order to obtain a psychological evaluation, and that's the unprofessional conduct. And the state asks you to adopt the order.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. So having heard argument from both sides on the ALJ's recommended decision, we would go into discussion, but I will make a motion for legal advice or executive okay. session for legal advice, second by Dr. Medina. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. We're back in open session. It's 11:03 a.m. And we are discussing the ALJ's recommended decision. So we heard from, in sort of like starting the discussion, we heard from counsel for both the state and Dr. Huggins as to the findings of fact. My inclination is to not modify the findings of fact. My inclination is to accept the findings of fact as entered by the administrative law judge. And my reason for that is we heard that there need to be some additions to give more context. But I think at least I am persuaded by the fact that the scope of the decision was the interim order that was not complied with by Dr. Huggins. It wasn't with the underlying sort of personal life events that were alluded to. So those facts just simply are irrelevant to the subsequent analysis of the conclusions of law. So there's nothing, at least in my view, that needs to be added or modified in the findings of fact that would lead potentially to a different conclusion as the next step. And also we sort of heard about this, deletion of all mentions of unprofessional conduct. And that's at least, again, in my perspective, just a recital of what our statutes require the state to prove. And the state did prove there was unprofessional conduct. So I do not agree with the recommendation from Dr. Huggins' counsel that we delete mentions of unprofessional conduct. That's just a recitation of what's in the statute. And, it's a term of art. So I'll stop there and see if there is any further discussion. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely agree. I think that the arguments that Dr. Huggins did not receive notifications, and yet notifications were sent to the email address and last known physical address listed by Dr. Huggins. So I don't know how the board staff could divine knowledge of some other delivery system that would alter that. Counsel for Dr. Huggins indicated that she did not attend did not honor the subpoena and did not attend the board nor the administrative law judge hearing because of family emergencies. But this is the first we've heard of that. We didn't hear from Dr. Huggins about that. We heard it this morning from her counsel. And so if it was such an emergency, it seems like that Dr. Huggins would have communicated that to the board at some juncture along this way. This has been going on for months now. And that simply was not done. I concur that we should not modify the terms, and we should accept the recommendations as put forth by the administrative law judge. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All right, then I'll make a motion to accept the findings of fact as recommended by the administrative law judge.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any more discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. So we have gone through the findings of fact. The next part is to look at the conclusions of law and see if we can accept, reject, or modify them. So on this, my inclination would be to allow counsel for both parties to make brief statements. If you wish to do so, I'll allow that. And Ms. Galvin goes first if she wishes to.
I don't have anything to add. The conclusions of law provide that the ALJ found evidence to support a violation of 16AA, which is violating a formal board order as it relates to the interim order to get a psych eval, and 16BB, her failure to furnish information to the board or its representatives or comply with a subpoena, which she also failed to do.
Thank you, Ms. Gavin.
I would just say that for the record that Dr. Huggins did not receive the subpoena. I was out of town at the time. We're happy to submit a sworn declaration to that fact. She also has a witness that can appear on her behalf to attest to the fact that she was not there and did not receive the notice because she was out of town. She also provided an email response to the board's emails that informed the board that her, the complainant, one of the complainants, had actually installed spyware onto her computer. That was well documented, and the emails from the board were actually blocked, and that was provided to the board earlier, and we would be happy to furnish the board with a copy of that. Otherwise, I would agree with Ms. Galvin that the conclusions of law are a fair statement of the law applicable to this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Galvin or Dr. Huggins' counsel? Hearing none, let's go into our discussion of the conclusions of law. To get us started, I think the conclusions of law are pretty straightforward and standard and expected in what we see from an ALJ's decision. So my inclination would be to accept the conclusions of law as recommended by the ALJ. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My inclination as well would be to accept the conclusions of law as put forth by the administrative law judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion or motion? Okay, I'll make a motion to accept the ALJ's recommended conclusions of law.
Second
by Dr. Stewart. I think we need to do a roll call for this. Yes.
You can, Mr. Diner, you can just do a voice vote for this. Roll call is only necessary once you get to the board order.
Okay, thank you. Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. So that takes us to the order part of the ALJ's decision. And it's, again, a standard order based on the foregoing. The judge recommends that the license be summarily suspended and further recommends the board to revoke Dr. Huggins' license. Any discussion on that? Any motion? Okay, I'll make a motion to accept the ALJ's recommended order.
Second.
There is a second by Dr. Medina. Any further discussion? Roll call, please, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe.
Noting three recusals as well.
Thank you. So I think this concludes the matter before the board. The board's decision will be reduced to writing and sent out to the parties, and the appeal rights will also be set forth in the board's written order. Thank you, everybody, for attending on this matter.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give the next CE code word. The next CE code word is pencils. Pencils. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so that with that, what's the next agenda item we should go to, Ms. Pakkanen?
If Dr. Stewart is ready, perhaps agenda item 11.
All right. 11 is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of complaint number T2402 against Ronnie Mans, unlicensed, to include the CSC's recommendation to issue a cease and desist order and make referrals to the Arizona Attorney General's Office and the Arizona State Board of Nursing.
Dr. Stewart, please, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Ronnie Manns has held himself out in his publications and on his website to be a doctor of psychology and also an NP, which I am presuming to be nurse practitioner. And we cannot find that he has ever held a license as a psychologist, nor as a registered nurse, and not as a nurse practitioner. He has also referred to himself as a neuropsychologist. His response is that through his training, he has various certificates from the United Kingdom that say that he has had training as a neuropsychologist. And before the board, and also as it was, as the board pointed out, as board staff pointed out to him that this was in violation, he agreed to change those things. And apparently a recent review by board staff shows that his website was still up and he had not changed those. So before the board today is the a person practicing in the state of Arizona without a license, holding himself out to be a psychologist and presumably a nurse practitioner.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any questions for Dr. Stewart? All right, then let's go to Dr. Manns. If you're present, now would be the time to unmute and you can make a statement of up to 5 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I just want to note for the record, when I informed Mr. Manns of this upcoming board meeting and the CSC's recommendation, I asked if he'd be attending today as there were concerns. He replied to me just stating simply no. A few hours later, I received a message saying yes. So it's not clear that he was planning to attend today, and I don't see that he's here.
Okay. So I guess we don't have...
Also, Mr. Chair, may I interject? We have sent notifications to Drs. Catarino and Davey to return. I don't see Dr. Catarino at all. I'm trying to affirm if Dr. Davey's here. Oh, there's Dr. Catarino. Okay, very good.
Yeah, thank you for taking care of that. It wasn't on my mind.
Yes. So just for Dr. Catarino and Dr. Davies' benefit, we've moved to agenda item 11.
All right. And we don't have the complainant present, correct?
Mr. Chair, no,
there is no complainant. Yeah, right. That's
open by board staff, correct?
Okay, so let's go into our deliberations on this matter. Dr. Stewart, do you want to get us started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd appreciate that opportunity. This is rather concerning for me that someone brazenly in some of the publications that this fellow has, he's talking about giving medical advice and alluding to practice way beyond the scope of somebody that doesn't have a license at all. He's also not licensed by the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners in the state, so he's not exempted. I don't know that he is employed in a governmental agency that would qualify him as an exemption for the use of the term psychologist or not. But certainly I think cease and desist and also referral to the Board of Nursing Examiners as well as to the Attorney General's office. Thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I'm extremely concerned and am really scared for the public. The public doesn't know any different, and He's advertising himself, again, giving medical advice and doing neuropsychological work, and he doesn't have the training necessary to present that on his website in the state of Arizona. So I really am concerned about the public and the protection of the public here.
Dr. Caterina?
I went very closely through the courses and even the one in England. I don't even see a college degree. I see one psychology course in a business class, which he mentions as a minor. I don't know how he can list PsyD. I was wondering about that. Most of the courses are Coursera that are given for non-credit. So that's very concerning. Yes, I think that this, to me, this seems quite, like, definitely a legal matter that needs to be brought up before the Attorney General and needs to be pursued. It's very, it's extremely concerning. It's one of the most egregious things I've seen. So thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion or motion? Well, I can make a motion, I suppose. I make a motion to issue a cease and desist order and refer this case file to the Arizona Attorney General's office and to the Arizona Board of Nursing.
Second
by Dr. Seidman. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Dr. Stanton.
Sorry, I'm not raising my hand. I couldn't get to my button quick enough. Is there a means in which to expedite the safety of the public by stopping this gentleman from practicing? I don't know how quickly it can be done, but I have grave concerns. I mean, he's you know, like was mentioned by some of the other board members, you know, indicating he has a PsyD, nurse practitioner, and I'm looking at his information here, and it's a lengthy list of all these areas of expertise. Yet it's possible he has no areas or nothing in those areas of expertise. And so there's just a concern and that this is going to continue for at least a few more days, 2 weeks until this is stopped. And so I don't know if there's a means in which this could be stopped quickly. I don't know how else to say it. So.
I guess, Ms. Galvin, the question is, can we go for an injunction?
Typically, we do a cease and desist first. If we went straight to an injunction, you're looking at, perhaps several weeks. We could get it drafted within, say a week or so. But then by the time it's filed, served, he gets a chance to, respond. And then you appear before a judge. That could be lengthy as well. A cease and desist could be, issued, within perhaps by the end of the day. In my opinion, your best bet for the most efficient and effective perhaps resolution would be the referral that you've made to the AG's office criminal section, who take these types of allegations very seriously and may be able to act more, quickly than an injunction.
Thank you for that insight, Ms. Galvin. Any further discussion? So the motion is for cease and desist for now, and then the referrals will take care of the concern that Dr. Stenhoff had in terms of, can we move quickly to have him stop? All right. I think we need a roll call for this, Ms. Galvin.
You do not.
Okay. Then voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Where to next, Ms. Pakkanen?
Mr. Chair, I suggest item 16.
16. 16 is discussion, consideration, and possible action to include potential criminal referrals and seeking injunctive relief regarding information received concerning Blake Harding, unlicensed in Arizona, previously issued a cease and desist order by the board on January 12th, 2024. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please provide an overview?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The board members likely recall the events of January of this year, whereby two actions were taken relative to and concerning Blake Harding. One of those was to issue a cease and desist, finding that he was representing himself in various ways to be a psychologist or authorized to practice in some capacity as a psychologist in Arizona. That information was derived from not only third-party content sources, but also his own website on which he proclaimed to be able to provide psychological services in Arizona, falsely claimed a SciPact privilege and various other false at a minimum, misleading statements. And so that cease and desist order was issued. Concurrently, Harding had applied for the practice authorization to deliver services into Arizona via the telehealth registry. That application was denied as the board found that not only did he not meet the eligibility requirements in multiple instances, but he also made false statements and misrepresentations when seeking, approval, when seeking that authorization. And I've provided you with not only the documents, but also in your memorandum, a summary of these facts and the violations that were, associated with them. So very, very recently, a member of the public, the initials JR are associated with this individual, contacted the board, board staff having found on the board's website these actions. And this individual came forward with concerns because his daughter, a young adult, had received what she perceived to be and understood to be psychological services from Harding. It was clear, it was articulated to me and made clear by JR in the communication that we subsequently received that this this care arrangement was made with the understanding that Harding is a licensed psychologist in Arizona, which of course he is not. So JR painstakingly supplied at our request, two detailed summaries of, what their concerns were, what they understood to be the case, and really the events as they see them from the time that service provision began in late 2023 till, very recently. JR and his daughter became concerned with sort of strange behavior on the part of Harding, which really precipitated the research and the inquiry that JR made. JR also submitted information constituting communications between Harding and himself. And so, there's content in those communications, which I think the board is going to identify many concerns of, what is represented in them. JR also submitted a extensive ledger of charges for services dating back to November of 2023 and explained that he feels thwarted in their efforts to try to obtain records to justify the billing and the treatment and services provided. So with that, I bring this to you. JR has asked the board to respect his decision to not participate in the proceeding today, or this, the review of this today. The board has some options available that I have explained in the memorandum. Those are better explained to you by Ms. Galvin, and I'm sure you'll have questions for her. In terms of the report, the content, or any of this history, does the board have questions for me?
Dr. Katerina?
The only question I had is, I have so many, but he said it's licensed in Washington. Did you find that? Because I looked up the Washington state and I did not see any license there.
Mr. Chair, thank you for posing that question, Dr. Katerina. We have in the past validated that he holds, some sort of a restricted authorization, not in psychology, but a very limited authorization to deliver services under supervision. So that is true, or was true at one point anyway, where the state of Washington was concerned. And then there were a couple of other authorizations that other jurisdictions issued that enabled Harding to obtain, acquire education, in an effort to meet that state's licensure requirements or maybe training. But I find none of that to be germane or relevant, because what we're looking at are a set of facts that Harding in the state of Arizona delivered services to an individual present in the state of Arizona. So I don't see that any of those authorizations enable him to do what the record suggests he did.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to clarify that.
And as a clarification, Dr. Katerina, I think on page 9 of our materials, it says the Washington Mental Health Counselor Associate license is not comparable or substantially similar because it does not allow practice at an independent level of psychologist. So that's the license he has, and it's not comparable.
Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Pakkanen? All right, so discussion, or would anybody like an executive session for legal advice? Dr. Flint?
Sorry, go ahead with your suggestion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'll make a motion for executive session for legal advice.
Second.
Second by Dr. Katerina. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Session, it is 11:46 a.m. Still on item number 16. Any discussion or motion? Dr. Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note my extreme concern in cases like this, but this case particular, and the courage that it takes for an individual to come forward and say something's wrong here is incredible. And I just want to put that on the record, that that does not go unrecognized. And the fact that this individual has been clearly explained to what the rules are and continues to clearly put himself out there as doing psychological services of a variety of different kinds is exactly why we are here to try and help protect the public. And I firmly believe this is an exemplar case of that needing to happen because people have potentially been hurt. I just wanted to put on the record that I give great nods to the individuals who have come forward.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I absolutely concur with Dr. Flint's assessment. I think this is of urgent matter and severity. And I also commend the parent coming forth of the child who had received services. And I think we need to act in all due haste to get this guy to cease and desist. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any discussion or motion? I'll just say, you know, this is egregious. When we saw this in January, I think we were all shocked with what was happening. And now we sort of have somebody who's hurt. And that's just galling. That's just horrible. I'll make a motion that we ask for an injunction, assuming some further cooperation from witnesses and victims, and refer the matter to the Arizona Attorney General's Office Criminal Division. Second by Dr. Medina. Any discussion? Do we need a roll call? No. All right, voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to give out the next CE code word. The next CE code word is crayons. Crayons, thank you.
Where should we go next, Ms. Pekkanen?
Mr. Chair, why don't we do the mid-year ASPPB 2024 mid-year meeting report, because we have both Drs. Catarino and Medina here. So I suggest that item.
Okay. So we'll do that item, and then I want to take a comfort break. So number 13 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding ASPPB 2024 mid-year meeting report. And Dr. Catarino, maybe you start, and then Dr. Medina after you.
Okay, that's fine. So I had just about two or three things I wanted to mention. First, I wanted to give a summary of what I thought was the best presentation, but then it was Ms. Packerman's, and I was a little embarrassed to do that, but she did an excellent job. So then I had to pick one of the second best, which was, I thought, an interesting one from Minnesota, where they started a pilot program for applicants that did not pass the EPPP. So they have about an overall pass rate of 64%. It would be interesting to know what ours is. You know, I don't know. But they have about 3,600 licensees, and they get about 145 new licensees each year. So they what they did is they noticed in the last 5 years, 45 people took the EPPP and didn't pass. They set up a test prep program, and they picked applicants who self-identified as people of color, who provided services to medically underserved areas and population, and provided services in languages other than English. Then they initiated contact with these people two times. They ended up with about 20 applicants, and they're working with them with this text prep. And at this point, not everyone agreed to participate, but they have 8 participants who are studying for the exam. 3 are scheduling their exam, and actually 1 passed now. So that might be something that we think about if we have, you know, funds and time to do that. But I thought that was sort of a nice success story there. I have 2 other things I wanted to mention. I met one thing that I personally was happy about. In a previous meeting, I met with someone from Oklahoma. Dr. Stewart was with me, and she didn't understand how she could get internship sites that were APIC accredited. So we explained to her about the consortium, what we have in Arizona. So in between the 2 meetings, within a couple months, she set up a whole consortium, and now Oklahoma has that APIC program based on just the networking that we had at the meeting. And then the last thing I wanted to say is I met with Dr. Song, who's the statistician research coordinator, and they're getting together. They're setting up like how many people pass that are graduated from an APA accredited program or that have APA internships, how many maybe other demographics. And so she has the capability to do any of these studies, she said, in the national database. So I thought it might be something we should be thinking of what type of, you know, we would want to do for our state, or that we want to get involved with her nationally about looking at the types of preparation that lead to passing scores on the ECCC and things like that. So, because she has a whole bunch of data and she was very cooperative and willing to work with us. So those are the few things I wanted to mention. That's it.
Thank you, Dr. Katerina. That was a good report. Dr. Medina.
Yeah, thank you. I want to mention that contrary to what at first I thought, oh, well, I don't know how much I'm going to get out of this session. I actually got quite a bit. It was on the high stakes of exams and test security. And in that presentation by Pearson, first they discussed sort of the emergence of the remote online proctoring into high stakes testing spaces. This was following, of course, the pandemic and COVID-19. And also they talked about the challenges that credentialing bodies face in serving the preferences and interests of candidates versus the requirements to protect the public and maintain the security and integrity of the examination. They talked about two very interesting cases, and this is sort of what the second portion was, you know, kind of showing the ramifications of, when the testing security is compromised. And in one case, which happened in Florida, a woman that ran a training company to train students, her staff, she would send her staff to go in and memorize questions that she was selling the questions to the students and even selling them on Amazon. So that was one alarming case. And then the other one in Georgia, and happened with a pharmacy exam and the board that the teachers actually were behind the scheme, and it really had huge ramifications for the whole state because they could not even issue licenses for 6 months. They had to retire the examination completely because the teachers, they would harvest the content and were selling it again to students. And so they had to stop testing and issuing licenses for about 6 months until the new test was developed. And so I think, sometimes we think, I don't know, that it's too rigorous. Sometimes it's hard to get scheduled because of the test security issues, right? You have to go to a testing center and things like that. But there is a good reason for that. And I could not even imagine if we could not issue licenses for any period of time because we had to wait for a new licensing exam. That would be pretty atrocious. So it was a very interesting and enlightening presentation. And then the other one I'll mention quickly was on the ECCC part one, part two, and they really went into detail of in regards to how the items are chosen and all the rigorous processes that an item goes through to even make it to the exam. So I think that also was very informative. And they also talked about the PEP, which is the exam for the prescribing psychologist that we do not have yet, but it is helpful to learn for, one day if we go down that route. So my key points.
Thank you, Dr. Medina, for that report. So I think there isn't any motion, but I just wanted to point out that these are all the reasons why ASPPB meetings should be attended by board members. I think having these insights and sharing them at our board meetings is valuable. So maybe we can use that as one of the reasons, Ms. Pakkinen, for you know, funding reasons or whatever. So I think it's 11:58. Let's take a comfort break, come back at 12:15. Okay, it's 12:15 p.m. and we are back in open session. Ms. Packner, I think the next one is number 15. Am I missing something in between?
No, Mr. Chair, that is what I have as well. So here we are again. We find ourselves that, you know, even though our meetings are pre-scheduled, you know, before any a particular calendar year begins, then we later learn about scheduling conflicts with other events that take board staff away from the board meeting and board members. And so that's the case with the November board meeting. What I heard earlier was an instance or discussion around likely sending me, and there may be as many as three board members attending. Certainly one, could be two, possibly three. And so, you know, that really introduces, you know, quorum issues. So not having that clarity and just, you know, my own reticence that I don't want to, you know, my commitment is I serve the board. I don't want to, you know, to have to, you know, delegate that responsibility, staffing board meetings to Ms. Michelson any more frequently than is necessary. I mean, sometimes I need to go to France and that's necessary, but I try to be judicious in the process. So I really would prefer to be available to staff that meeting. There are some agenda items that I really, you know, maintain a high degree of involvement in that, you know, could very well be on the November agenda. So the date that we are hoping might work for everyone is the Monday, after which it would be normally scheduled. And I just lost my calendar. I think we're talking about Monday, November 4th. Are we not?
Yes, Ms. Packard, on that.
Thank you. Yes. So the just to be clear, the meeting that's currently scheduled for November 1, a Friday, we're requesting that perhaps it be moved to Monday, November 4th. And if that's not possible, you know, if we have quorum concerns and so forth, then, you know, it may be that we need to consider other dates. That being said, we don't have, you know, a whole lot of latitude to move meetings, you know, a significant number of days because of, you know, what I've described in the past as this, choreography that needs to happen in terms of timing of committee meetings, forwarding particularly applications to board meetings. So, you know, the more that we change that sort of timing, there are implications that are, you know, are mostly felt by applicants and other parties as well. So we try to minimize adverse impact on our customers and stakeholders.
So, Ms. Pekkanen, so I see the ASPPB annual meeting goes through November 3rd, and I'm assuming there might be some travel time back from Dallas involved for those who are attending. So just making sure that, you know, November 4th would still work in terms of, you know, we don't want, like, people to take red eye and then 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, there's a meeting, right? So just keeping that in mind and trying to sort of think ahead of like flight delays and that sort of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate that. Generally speaking, the meetings wrap up at 11:30, 12 on Sundays. So, you know, and that's done, you know, intentionally to allow individuals, you know, travel time home, assuming that they have obligations on Monday. To your point, the airlines are going to do what the airlines do. And so, you know, that's just a variable that needs to be considered.
Dr. Katerina?
I I can make that date, but I would have to leave about 2:15, 2 o'clock, just so you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, and from my perspective, Monday meetings work for me, but maybe I have this sort of rather unique situation because my employer, we have a strict rule, no Monday meetings, because Monday meetings at work are just soul-sucking. Everyone comes to the office thinking they'll start the day, you know, being productive, and then you're stuck in a two-hour meeting. So we don't have Monday meetings. So Monday works very well for me, but again, not everybody is in the same situation. So I understand that.
Chairman Diner, I don't think you could have said it better, as Monday meetings are soul-sucking. I think that should be, you know, our mantra. Unfortunately, looking at that, the next, I will actually be in Austin, Texas for a conference. With the time change, there may be some wiggle room there, but I would definitely have to kind of like weave my way around that meeting. I apologize.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm able to attend, but I would have to arrive around 9:15. So,
Dr. Medina,
is it possible to do it on Friday the 8th? So keep it on a Friday, but just the following Friday, or?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Medina, yes, that is, we can do that. I would not want to go any more, any dates past that. That's sort of the, you know, end point, you know, that I think would be, to minimize the implications that I was alluding to earlier. So yes, pushing it into the next week, that's where we run into issues.
And if I just may know, I don't see this as being an issue, but if we reschedule the board meeting date to November 8th, I just want to let us, for the committee members on the complaint screening committee, we do have a subsequent meeting on the 20th. So it'd be a quick turnaround time between the board meeting and CSC, about a week and a half. And that applies to Mr. Nguyen and Dr. Stewart and Medina.
The 4th is fine as well. We can make it work. I mean, I can make it work. It's far enough in advance that I can make it work. So either
way. So I think I'm hearing more quorum issues on the 4th as opposed to the 8th. But maybe Ms. Pakkanen, 8th works out because it's a Friday, but any more thoughts on this, or I think you have enough direction, like whatever you need.
Yeah, I'm not hearing anyone else articulate concerns with the November 8th meeting. So if that is the consensus, you know, staff will make that happen. And there may need to be, that sounds like there will need to be, you know, some, we'll have to recalibrate some expectations, you know, that comes along with that process. And so we'll do that.
All right. So then the next thing on the agenda is number 17, new agenda items for future meetings. And just, I wanted to note this, and my thoughts are like by no means well thought out or well evolved, but I think we saw two cases today where, you know, we were struggling with cease and desist and, you know, can we go with injunctions? And I think the issue there is we need to do cease and desist before we can take any sort of court action against somebody who is just an egregious violator of our statutes and rules. I think the reason we have to do the cease and desist comes from the way that the statutes are written. So I wonder if we should give some thought to potentially looking at those statutes and having a discussion as to, you know, whether they need to be, whether we need to recommend to the legislature that they should, you know, maybe give boards, not just the psychology board, but just, you know, boards in general, the authority to sort of move quicker in the interest of protecting the public from imposters like we saw today. And I think that goes along with the mission of the board to protect the public. And, you know, sometimes there is cause to take quick action. And I think I've sensed some frustration, not just from my part, but from other board members as well, to sort of, you know, okay, that's the only thing we can do at this time. And we want to do something more, but we can't because our hands are tied. So maybe taking a look at that makes sense. Again, I'm just thinking aloud. By no means is this well thought out. Ms. Pakkinen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do some more thinking, of course, on this. My initial thought, though, is that this is a great topic to bring to there's a monthly meeting that the executive directors of the regulatory boards, we engage with members of Governor Hobbs' staff on regulatory issues. And, you know, there have been obviously, you know, some conversations around the directives that Governor Hobbs issued earlier this year, you know, that we, of course, are as a board and I assume all other boards are complying with. And so because this issue is what I'm perceiving, it's received more attention than it has for quite some time. I think we would find, you know, some receptivity, I think is a word, on the part of the governor's staff if we were to ask to explore that topic at the next meeting. So I'm happy to be, you know, the conduit to start, at least start some discussions there. So that was my immediate reaction.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. That makes sense to me. Dr. Medina?
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add to what Heidi was saying. I think the case that we saw on item 16, right, is a perfect example of what happens. You know, if you don't, not that we didn't act, we did issue the cease and desist, but I think, you know, what more could be done? Because the reality is he got to unfortunately work or see or sell his services to someone who was quite vulnerable and in need of you know, real help. And, you know, it's just concerning that we cannot do more or much faster. And that case just really shows exactly why. Thank you.
Ms. Pakkinen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, because I'm always motivated to try to find more work for this board to do. Really, what I'm about to say is just by way of reminder, there will be some items coming back to you that you've requested, that you have, you know, heard in the past, but they need to, you know, sort of come back again for some implementation and so forth. So the three items that I would expect to bring to you as early as September and then, you know, throughout some of your fall meeting agendas. Next month, we hope to have a recommendation relative to an analysis of the board statute and rule language that addresses, you know, at what point EPPP candidates would be potentially eligible to test. And so, you know, some of the work has been done, and there are some, my analysis anyway, that Dr. Medina gave, you know, some review and input into. That's with Ms. Galvin. And so that may be on your September meeting agenda that we take a look at that issue. I don't want the board to forget that Dr. Catarino had requested an item specific to, you know, a better understanding of pass rates based on you know, where the education and what programs that the education was, you know, acquired. So we needed to give the psychometrician, Dr. Song from ASPPB, some time, you know, to really look into that data. And I haven't checked in with her to see where that is, but I certainly will. And then the third item is that I think I'm ready to bring a proposal to the board fairly soon concerning the, do you remember the error assessment that the representative from Thentia, our licensing platform, Mr. Rick Borges presented to us? It's the board self-assessment exercise, you know, so we can sort of benchmark our performance against other regulatory boards. I think I have three quarters of an idea developed for how we might, you know, try to move forward. So that, I don't know if that's going to be on September's agenda, but relatively soon I'll have a recommendation, a proposal. So, I haven't forgotten about these items. I will time them strategically in the coming months.
I appreciate that, Ms. Paikkanen. And the last item was I'd forgotten. So thank you for keeping tabs on that. Any further items board members would like to put on a future meeting agenda? All right, hearing none, let's see. We are exactly 4 hours long. The meeting has been 4 hours and 1 minute long. So maybe Ms. Poe, you want to give the last code word and then I can adjourn.
Yes, the last code word is homework. Homework. Thank you.
See, that's the real test, like somebody who's stuck all the way through. All right, so I'll exercise my privilege to adjourn. It's 12:32 and we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for attending and for your hard work.